about 1230 to 1240, and was entirely destroyed in 1536 when the dissolution of the monastery took place. It's a very large church, 180 feet long, as most of the monastic churches were, and the nave of the church was used by the local parishioners, hence its size, and was used by them for various activities as well as for church services. And the choir and presbytery, which are on the other side of the brick wall, were used by the canons for the daily services, which took place all through the 24 hours. And the church was connected with the eastern range by a staircase into the dormitory, so that they could take part in the night services. The original cloister is still marked out here, and the church stood on the north side of the cloister, the chapter house and dormitory on the east side. We still have the dining hall here on the south side, converted to farm buildings in Tudor times, and a portion of the western range, which consisted of the cellarage and guest rooms.
The medieval remains, which are on the, what, the south side?
Yes.
Can you show me something about those?
Well, the dining hall is built of the local Sussex ironstone, and it still has in the north wall the little four arches of the lavatorium, or wash place, which was an important feature of every cloister, where they washed before going into their meals. Adjacent to it is the well, which dates back, we think, to the 13th century. And this building was repaired and re-roofed by the Pelham family in the late 16th century and converted into farm buildings, and in this century has been converted into a modern residence. And next to it, on the western side, is the two-storied western range, built of Sussex green sandstone, brought probably from quarries at Eastbourne, and that consisted of the entrance hall and the parlour, and above the guest rooms for travellers and visitors to the priory.
Can you tell me something of the order of monks?
Yes, the Augustinian canons were the order here, and they were a very widespread and popular order. They were not monks, they were priests in full orders, and they were what was called an open order, that is to say they could move out from the monastery and be appointed to serve parish churches and travel about amongst the local population. There were 12 canons and a prior on the original foundation, as was the custom with most of the Augustinian monasteries. But we know from the records that during most of the 300 years history of the monastery, the full number was seldom attained here. After the Black Death in 1349, there were only 5 canons left. And at the dissolution in 1536, there were 6 canons, who became parish priests in the modern sense of the word after the dissolution.
This was actually destroyed by the order of Henry.
Yes, Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It wasn't just let to go to ruin.
No, we know that some of the buildings were partially ruined even before the dissolution, because they'd been pleading poverty for many years before that date, and the roof of the refectory is recorded as having fallen in, and it's possible that the other buildings were also in some disrepair. The reason for this poverty, which was, occurs a lot in the records, is due probably to the enormous amount of charitable work that they were expected to do, including the hospitality they had to give to travellers and pilgrims and any sick or old people who could come and claim succour at the gate of the monastery every day. And all the monasteries seem to have spent an enormous part of their endowments in this work.
This monastery hasn't got a wall around it. It's got a moat around it, which is part of the River Cookmere. Mm. Can you tell me something about this?
Yes, well, this is an unusual feature of Mitcham, that it was an island site, and we think it dates back to pre-conquest times, because the word Mitcham is Anglo-Saxon and means the Great Bend or the Great Loop, which refers to the double loop of the river. And probably after they built the monastery, they felt that this waterway system could be converted into an adequate defence for the monastery, and so there never was built a precinct wall. But with most monasteries, especially those in towns, they were provided with very high stone walls as the main defence. But the moat at Mitcham is one of the largest moats ever constructed in England, and is over 40 feet wide in places, and it seemed likely that this was considered to be an adequate defence all through its history. From excavations which we are carrying on at the moment, we find that there was a medieval building at the bottom of the South Lawns, which could not have been there when the moat was there. So it seems that the moat was built after that building, namely in the 14th century, probably when the gatehouse was built, when they found the need for adding to the fortifications after the peasant revolt in 1381, when all the monasteries were attacked by the local peasantry. And, of course, the moat and river system also provided drainage, sewerage, and a fish supply.
The Pelham family came here in
1587.
Mm-hmm. And stayed how long?
They only lived here. They did live here for about 15 to 20 years. But it was Herbert Pelham, who was a younger son of the then Pelham family, and he spent a large part of his fortune on restoring Mitcham and building the big stone farmhouse here. And he got into financial difficulties, and he had to place the property in the hands of trustees in 1600. And in 1603, the whole property was sold to the Sackville family. And the Sackvilles owned it until just before 1900 and had tenants mainly here through the 300 years of their ownership, most of whose names we know from some old rent books which have been found in Lewes in recent years.
The Sackville family, is there much history about them?
No, very little history as far as Mitcham is concerned. They don't seem to have many records in their family archives of their ownership of Mitcham. There was a rather interesting map of William Figg, came to light some years ago in Lewes, dated 1790, showing the Sackville property at Mitcham. And beyond these rent books, which give the lists of the tenants and the amount of rent they paid and the amount of wood they could cut and that kind of detail, we know very little about the Sackville ownership, and they don't seem to have done very much to the buildings through all that time.
After they left, who?
During the 20th century, three private families have owned Mitcham, including the Gwynns of Polegate, and they have done, between them, quite a lot of restoration work and a good deal of alteration inside the priory buildings to modernise the house. Particularly the Wright family in the 1920s restored it and converted the old refectory into the modern residence. And they did farm the lands through all those years up till 1959, when the lands were sold and the house was given to the Sussex Archaeological Trust. Lock. Repeater clock made in Holborn by John Shaw about 1690, with a crystal pendulum, chased face and backplate, ebony veneered case, and original works. The clock has recently been repaired and is in full working order, and is a quarter chiming clock. And if you pull the little side cord, it should chime for us. About 1600, and it's made of poplar wood, hand-carved, out of the solid block. Some of the pawns are modern reproductions, which you will notice are made in two parts, pinned together. And it's very unusual to have a coloured set and a black set. And I can't get a board large enough because the bases are all unusually large. And none of the old chessboards that I've found so far are big enough for it. But it is a unique set that, as far as we know, was given to us by somebody in Eastbourne some years ago. And it's French. This is an old, what they call a farmhouse clock, made in Lewes by the well-known Richard Comber, the well-known Lewes clockmaker, about 1760. And it's got its original brass face and glass, and it's a single-handed clock, just the hour hand. And it is in full working order, has a long pendulum inside, and it has to be wound every 24 hours by pulling the cord down. And it's weight-driven, and it does chime the quarters and the hours in an oak case, the original oak case. That came from the museums in Lewes. Wait a moment, it might strike. We've had a great deal of trouble with this clock making it work. Pelham's kitchen of his farmhouse, and he built this enormous chimney and chimney breast fireplace about 1600, and this was opened up and cleaned and lit about 5 years ago, and it contains the smoke chamber on the left of the chimney where the meat was hung for curing, and on the right the main chimney houses the big iron smoke jack which was driven by the heat of the fire and connected to the spit by a chain, so it drove the spit round with the meat on it. And the chimney is entirely built of old priory stone with a bit of Tudor brick at the bottom and a tree trunk holding up the outside wall. It's one of the largest Tudor fireplaces in Sussex. And this originally probably contained a priest's hiding hole. And it has been modernised to some extent because of a fire, to have some new timbering put in. But there is still a big shaft in between the panel walls where you can climb up to the attic bedrooms through the chimney shafts. You get in through that hole up there, there's a ladder fits in here, and there are trapdoors and ladders, vertical ladders, up all the way up. A bit of medieval walling here, and this is Tudor framing. Of an earlier farmhouse built about 1560 by, we think, a Sussex yeoman who came and lived here and started to farm the lands some years after the dissolution.
What, before the Pelham?
Before the Pelhams bought it, yes.
So the Pelhams didn't go directly?
No, the Pelhams bought it from the royal trustees who'd held the land since the dissolution. But there had been a tenant farmer here, apparently, at some time, about 1560. And he converted some of the old stone walls into part of an early Tudor farmhouse, which is where the main staircase now goes up through the middle of the house. And that is why you've got fireplaces on the landing of this staircase, which are the original little fireplaces of this first farmhouse. And there are four rather nice stone mullioned Tudor windows on the south side.
They used to do this idea of having a fireplace on the actual staircase.
No. This, you see, it's now on the staircase, but it was originally in one of the three rooms of this early farmhouse, which was the floors of that farmhouse were pierced in 1925 to put in this modern oak staircase. But the whole of the original roof of the farmhouse is up there, and it encloses two of the original monastic windows, which were left in the stone walls after the dissolution. And this great big arch here in the west wall of the refectory is the great west window of the refectory, a rather interesting type of window of five lights under one great arch, and the date is almost exactly 1280. And that was boarded up when this farmhouse was built. And on this side, in order to make a wall, he had to put up this rough oak framing and fill it with brick noggin, as we call it. That's this herringbone laid brickwork and plasterwork. And that was the western wall of his little farmhouse. See the South Downs, 10 miles away at the coast, and the Crookmere Valley, which originally belonged to the priory, part of its grazing lands. And from the windows you can see the excavation of this medieval hall house on the south lawn, which is proceeding at the moment. And underneath this window is where the kitchens of the priory originally went. These were excavated in 1964, and a lot of medieval walling and hearths were found, as well as a drain to the moat.
What is the actual acreage?
Now?
Yes.
Well, the trust now owns there's 7 acres of land in the island. There's 8 acres of water around it, and a little bit of land outside. It makes about 18 to 20 acres altogether.
And but the original state?
Originally, of course, the priory was endowed by its founder, Gilbert of Pevensey, with nearly 1,000 acres of pasture land on Pevensey Marshes and in the Crookmere Valley, and also with manors and lands at Seaford and Brighton and in Kent and various other parts of the home counties. But the endowments of the monasteries were always spread about so that they didn't own too much land in one place, which would have made them too powerful an influence. Yes, the Sackvilles owned about 800 acres up till 1900, and gradually the lands have been sold off since then. And in 1959, the last 300 acres were sold as farmland. But originally, of course, this was entirely thick oaken forest, part of the Wealden Forest, which covered the Weald of Sussex, and this was felled in the up to the 18th century for timber and charcoal and for shipbuilding. So there's very little left of the trees now. We have a few very large oaks here, which probably were self-sown, and they're about 300 years old. But otherwise, they're just older trees and ash and around the moat.
This is where the timber came for Elizabeth the First.
Yes. Well, from Sussex and, of course, other parts of the south of England, Hampshire. But all the great oak forests were rapidly felled. And, of course, the iron industry being situated in Sussex because of the iron ore in the Wealden Stone, a large part of the forests were felled to make the charcoal to smelt the iron. Of course, they were very worried indeed about the shortage of suitable timber for shipbuilding, and we were beginning to import timber from abroad then. That's when our balance of payments trouble started, I think. This is the prior's principal guest room. As you can see, it's a beautiful, lofty room with It has now a ceiling in it, which was not here originally. It was originally open to the rafters. This ceiling was put in 1910 when the top of the building was restored and re-roofed. But it is a Renaissance-style ceiling with the big supporting beams and the joists. And the red filling that you see now was put in 1967 to bring some colour into the room, which otherwise was rather cold and white. And originally the room had a stone floor, which was supported by the vaulted undercroft below, and that floor was removed in 1925. But it still contains this magnificent canopied fireplace and chimney and south window, all of which are original and date from about 1320.
Stained glass window, how old is that?
The little stained glass window on the east side, that is quite modern. That was given to the Priory in 1965, made by a stained glass artist in New Haven, and it's modelled on the original seal of Prior Leam of 1377, of which a copy was found in London, and the two stained glass windows are based on that original design, showing on the left the figure of the Godhead seated and in the act of blessing, and on the right the personal seal of Prior Leam, which consists of probably the angel of the Annunciation, with this Latin motto surrounding it, which means, if you wish to be loved, you must love.
In the corner we've got this little sort of cavity.
Yes, that stone cupboard in the corner is the original cupboard, which is part of the structure. The rules of the monasteries lay down they must have these stone ventilated cupboards for storing their charters and valuables, because the charters, of course, were written on parchment, which had to be preserved in a suitably aired cupboard. And this still has its ventilating shaft going up into the open air. And originally it had a big oak door with two locks, and the prior had a key, and the sub-prior had the second key, and both were supposed to be present when the cupboard was opened. The seal of the Priory was their most precious possession, because no act that they carried out or letter written was legal without the seal being affixed to it. And so the original matrix of the seal was a very important part of the monastic possessions. And this was kept in this cupboard in the prior's quarters. Adjacent to this room there was a prior's bedroom and chapel. This doorway is a medieval doorway. And this was probably added later, at a later date, because originally the priors were supposed to live with the community, but this was practice ceased very early. And they had their own quarters, and they these here, we think, from the roof marks on the walls and other evidence that these private quarters stood here outside on the south side of the priors' room. And the principal guests who visited the monastery from time to time were accommodated in this room. And they came up the stone staircase on the outside through a big door, which is still on the western wall here. And the most important visitors were sometimes royalty that was travelling about the country. King Edward I spent a night in this room in 1302. And the bishop of the diocese usually came once a year or once in 2 years to inspect the priory and see what was going on, if the proper life was being maintained. And there are records of some of these visitations, as they were called, in the Chichester Diocesan records.
The actual seal of this fire is no longer?
No, you see, the original seal, of course, was a metal matrix, as they call them, engraved steel or metal die. And most of the matrices have been lost, because there are quite a lot in the Public Record Office and British Museum in London. But as regards Michelham, there was an impression in wax of the seal found affixed to a document in the Public Record Office, which records the sale of land near the Priory by Lewis Priory to Michelham in 1377. And the seal of Lewis and Michelham Priories are affixed to this document in London. And we've had exact copies made of this seal, and this is the one and only seal of Michelham that's ever been found. Though there must have been a great many seals, because each prior was entitled to have his own design if he wished. Though the what they call the obverse of the seal always remained the same, in this case the figure of the Godhead. And the reverse contained the prior's personal seal, which are quite modern. What we call our museum or exhibition rooms. One is houses all the material relating the priory's history, a lot of photographs, documents, maps, pictures, all the excavated material, pottery, coins found in the grounds. And this large exhibition room, which is lined with walnut panelling, houses this very beautiful collection of old musical instruments, which is on permanent loan to us here, and the Big Doll's House, which belongs to Eastbourne Corporation, which is housed here on permanent loan, and a very good collection of 18th and 19th century needlework samplers, some of which came from the museums in Lewes and some of which have been given to us by visitors.
What do these instruments date back to?
The earliest is 1700 or 1720, which is this Viola de Mori here, which is a very beautiful instrument and very elaborately made, probably French, and it's inlaid with ebony and ivory, and on the back of it, it has this beautiful resurrection scene, which is done in ivory and ebony with a gold halo around the head.
It's estimated to be dated from 16...
About 1700, or soon after 1700. It's not certain whether it's French or Austrian. That's the earliest instrument.
What's the strength of the wall?
This is that's a ferry, and that's an 18th century serpent. Well, 1800 it says here. That's made of wood, of course, bound with the bark of a tree. The mouthpiece is missing, but that one belongs to the National Trust, who've loaned it to us, because we didn't have a serpent, and they had a number to spare. But they were a military band instrument of the Georgian times. But this collection is largely composed of folk instruments from all over the world, very primitive instruments, which haven't changed over the centuries.
Would you say it's a bit unique to have all these instruments in one place?
Yes, well, the Mummery Collection, as this is called, is a very unusual, very well-known collection, well-known to those who are interested in this particular subject. And for a long time it had no home, and through a friend of the Priory it was offered to us for loan here. But there are not many musical instrument collections in the country, and this is a very fine one. And it's being added to from time to time. Mrs. Mummery lives in France. Yes, there's no more than that, counting all the miniatures. It has a very important miniature section, and there are about 350 instruments in the collection now, because she's constantly adding to it. And she travels a great deal and brings back instruments from the Far East and from the Middle East and from even from Russia. She brought back some pottery whistles last year. And she's interested in what is called the ethnographic side of instruments. That's to say, their design and development by different races in different parts of the world, and how the primitive races have not developed their instruments at all, whereas the European instruments have developed through the centuries and unchanged. Displayed the best of the tiles of the church floor of 14th century make date, probably made in kilns in Abbot's Wood, which is not far from the Priory. And they show the plain green and yellow tiles with the lead glaze and the pattern tiles which form the borders of the flooring. And these were in the chancel and choir floor. The nave, of course, had an earth floor, beaten earth. Well, the forests around were full of wild boars, which apparently existed in England certainly up to Tudor times, as well as wolves. And the grounds here are full of these boars' tusks. Also a great variety of pottery, and much of it from the continent. There's some majolica, which comes probably from Spain. Pottery from East and West Sussex. There are some small pieces of medieval bells, a few fragments of medieval stained glass, very clouded, but of course a small priory like this wouldn't have been able to afford very much glass. They would have had stained glass in the church and perhaps in the dining hall, and we have found quite a few fragments in the grounds. The slates in this corner are interesting. These are 14th century South Devon slates of rather beautiful colouring, ranging from dark green to purple. And these apparently were brought by sea up the coast from the ham quarries in South Devon, which are still working. And it seems the buildings other than the church, which had a leaded roof, were slated. And we think here the cloister was probably thatched. These coins are quite interesting. The most interesting is the silver halfpenny of Richard II, 1390 approximately. And these others of copper or bronze, these are jetons, which were official counters, as they call them, for instead of coinage. And these are mostly continental, showing the amount of foreign visitors that came to the monasteries, and that is also shown by the variety of pottery which has obviously been brought here by travellers. There's a German and a French counter now. These photographs have been very carefully collected over the years. This group here shows the actual excavations of the Priory Church in 1959, showing the actual foundations that remain and which are marked on the lawns now.
They've now been recovered.
It all had to be covered because otherwise it disintegrates. And some of these photographs on the right were only came to light last year in the Gwynn collections at in Polegate. And they show some very early pictures of the priory in the mid-19th century, which have given us some clues as to the alteration in the buildings. And these two show the undercroft before the modern floor was put in 1910, and which we have recently pierced last winter to reveal the base of the pillar which had been buried, and which has shown that the base of this building is of an earlier date than the building itself.
Actually, there's a considerable amount of changes in the building.
Oh, considerable. Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. This, you see, shows there's very little change between the Grimm drawing of 1785 and these late Victorian photographs. And then in the early 1900s, the aspect of the buildings was considerably changed by having all the old ivy pulled off and a new roof put on the Prior's building there. And the Tudor farmhouse underwent several alterations. Here's the laboratorium in the cloister, which was in some disrepair. And this is a photograph of it before it was repaired in 1910 by Mr. Gwynn. And here is a Grimm drawing of 1780 showing the cloister walls of the western range still standing on the ground floor with the big vaulting arches still in the wall and the doorways. Unfortunately, that was all pulled down and destroyed in soon after 1900. These are the patterns of the tiles of the floor, showing the completed patterns. Here's an interesting one with a dromedary and two palm trees on it, which shows crusading influence in the design of the tiles. This is probably a dove. And there were a great many fleur-de-lis, because the Augustinian priories were nearly all dedicated to the Trinity, and the fleur-de-lis in this form is, of course, a sign of the Trinity.
Something of the history of it during the war here.
Yes, there's a Home Guard booklet here, which was given to us by a member of the Home Guard. And for a short part of the war, this was a Home Guard headquarters. And this booklet shows some of the photographs of the staff here and the personnel, many of whom have been back to visit us to tell us about the period of the war when the Priory was occupied by the army. At first it was occupied by the Canadian forces in 1941-42. Who came to defend the south of England after Dunkirk, and they have left a lot of record of their occupation of the priory, which we have found out in the official archives in Ottawa, and a number of them have been here as visitors in the recent years. And then towards the end of the war it became in regular army occupation again, and it was a signals headquarters under Hayward's Heath. And the army finally left in 1946, but they did look after the house very well, and they all liked being here very much, what they told us. Brickwork, etc., found in the excavations in the grounds over the last 15 years. Well, there's a tile of, it's dated 1837. This came from the lean-tos of the barn, and is a local-made Sussex tile with the original oak peg holes. Square in section. It has this amusing inscription on it, rather illiterate, and scratched with a nail on the wet clay before the tile was put in the kiln. It's dated June the 20th, 1837, and it's inscribed, "When you lay this tile, think of me," F-I-N-K, "of me, for I wrote," R-O-T-E, "this, my dear friend," F-R-I-N-D, and unfortunately he never signed it. There's a very rare 14th century ridge tile, which was found in the drain down here, and that we've pieced together, it's almost complete. There's a very unusual. These are pieces of cooking dishes, earthenware cooking dishes with two handles. Flemish bricks used in buildings from the 15th century onward in England. And these were brought back from the Low Countries by the wool ships that took the English wool to the continent, and they brought back bricks as ballast.
Kind of back to this 1837 tile here. It's probably rather unique because people couldn't write in those days, could they?
Well, it's very unusual, and obviously he wasn't a very well-educated labourer who wrote it, but it is unusual, certainly, for that early date. And on the whole, it's quite well composed. There's a piece of medieval lead water piping, made exactly like a Roman water pipe, with a fat sheet of lead beaten out and then folded over like pastry, and welded at the top. That was found in the cloister. There's part of a Bellarmine jar, which was a continental stoneware jar meant for wine. That's probably a late 16th century. There's a medieval corbel found in the grounds. Here's a rather rare rye jar of these big water pots. And this, they have been found in different parts of Sussex, but this was a particularly large one. And we managed to piece nearly half it together from all these fragments. And they were made in rye potteries, probably 15th century. And a lot of other fragments of pottery of uncertain date. This side is all the Child family papers. These only came to light in a curious way a few years ago when an old lady named Anna Child died in Brighton, and her attic contained several boxes full of papers relating to the history of the Child family of Mitchell and Priory, which hadn't been known about before that. And one member of the family collected all these papers and letters, and has loaned them on permanent loan to the Priory. And it turns out the Child family came from Sevenoaks area in the... they're traced back to the 16th century or earlier as yeoman farmers. And they came here in 1791 as tenants of the Sackvilles and set up a big farming and cattle breeding operation at Mitchelham, breeding Sussex red cattle. And these letters mainly date from the Napoleonic era, and give a lot of the personal history of the family at Mitchelham. And this interesting book, A Historical Sketch of Mitchelham, by Frank Child, well, he was a boy born here in 1832, and he went to Lewis Academy for his education, and he wrote this very interesting account of the Priory's history with several pages of beautiful black and white pen and ink drawings. And these have been photocopied for display because we can't show all the pictures in the book. And here are some of his drawings. And it also was interesting because it contained this a copy of this very early map, a picture map of Mitchelham, which we had known existed but which we've never been able to find a copy of, dated 1667. And this shows a sort of representation of the Priory buildings in the second half of the 17th century, done by a carpenter of Arlington, which is the parish of Mitchelham. And we were very glad to find this copy of this old map in Frank Child's book. This is the family Bible of the Child family, which dates back to 1712 and contains a lot of entries of the family who were born or who died at Mitchelham in the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
They were a very large family.
They were a very large family, and they still are.
They're still present now, are they?
They're all very much so, yes. They're all over Kent and Sussex still. And one branch of them is related to the great banking family of Child, who founded one of the best-known banks in London in the 18th century. But the family left here in 1861. They gave up living in Mitchelham, went to live in Lewes, and became millers rather than farmers. But they had particularly Thomas Child, in the early part of the 19th century, made quite a name for himself breeding these Sussex Red cattle, which in fact we have discovered have sired nearly all the main herds in Sussex in the 19th century.
You've got the hair of one of the...
Here's one letter, contained this lock of rather beautiful Holbein hair. And most of them are quite legible, the letters, little extracts on these cards, and they tell about going to London for a visit to the zoo and seeing the first railway train in London and all that kind of thing, rather vivid accounts. And the account of the family moving from here in 1861 is quite interesting. It was pouring with rain, apparently, and they had farm wagons to move all their furniture to Lewes, and they all got soaking wet. But it sort of gives a very vivid idea of the life of that period. Here is a photocopy done for us by the East Sussex Archives Office in Lewes, and it shows the about 800 acres of land surrounding the priory. And all the field names which are listed here are still the same today, which is interesting. But originally, of course, they owned a great deal more land surrounding this area. Here's the an interesting map of the waterways. This is the first Ordnance Survey of 1872, and this copy was given to us by the British Museum, and the hand-coloured part shows the double loop of the River Cookmere and the great quadrilateral moat in the inside of the loop.